Hello, and welcome to another fascinating issue of Charlie Cook's Marketing Mentoring Program. A series of Sneaking Secrets. Your host is Charlie Cook. Charlie's been helping business owners attract more clients and maximize their profits for over two decades. And while most people were still trying to figure out how to use the web, a series of powerful monthly audio Charlie sold his second website for just under $1 million. Today, Charlie is one of the most sought-after business mentors on the web and a best-selling author, recommended by some of the top marketing and sales experts of all time, including Brian Tracy and Tom Hopkins. To get the maximum benefits out of this month's program, ask yourself these questions during the interview. How can I apply these ideas to my business and to my life? How do I do things differently and get better results? What actions can I take today, this week, and this month to reach my goals? And you'll want to listen to the interview more than once. Every time you do, you'll discover new ideas, new strategies, and new ways to sell more of your products and services, make more money, and be more successful. Today's guest is Mike Bosworth. Mike is about to show you how to sell with hard-to-sell products and services, and how to close many more sales. Buyers in the most realistic, difficult selling markets, and the founder and president of Mike Bosworth and Associates in Rancho Santa Fe, California. Mike has trained over 7,000 consultants, CEOs, entrepreneurs, and up-to-date and money salespeople.
Hello, this is Charlie Cook, and if you've ever wanted to take the guesswork out of selling, today's guest, Mike Bosworth, is going to share with you how to
Mike is the author of
Separate Yourself from the Competition, how to generate more qualified prospects,
solution selling, creating buyers in difficult selling,
and how to motivate prospects to take action and buy from you. I have Mike on the line ready to share with you his proven process for generating more qualified prospects and selling more. Michael, welcome to the call.
I'm happy to be here, Charlie.
Michael, I'm looking forward to getting your insights and ideas on making more sales today. But before we start, can you briefly tell us a little bit about your career and the first sale you ever made?
Oh my gosh, you want to go all the way back? That's a long ways.
Well, in brief.
Well, I'm 61 now, and I went into sales at the age of 27. And I was a former tech support person, application support person for Xerox Computer Services. And they were selling the world's first ASP, where you could call up a central computer which contained business applications, general ledger payables, receivables, inventory, order entry, material planning, et cetera. And they hired me right out of college at the age of 25 because I'd been to Vietnam. And I was on the help desk for a year. Then I went out 2 years and was a field application support person. So I'd go out and convert a business. It could be a manufacturing business, could have been a distribution business, a public government agency. From however they were doing their general ledger and inventory and billing before to doing it on our system.
So you were selling them to get them on your system.
Right. And in our system, the revenue model of that is actually very important in how it evolved into my selling model, because our revenue model back then was usage. So we billed our customers for the amount of room their data took in our computer. We billed them for every print line generated, whether they did short reports on their dumb terminals in their offices or we did high volume reports at our data center and delivered them the next morning. And for every carriage return, every transaction was 2 cents. So if they didn't use it, there was no revenue.
So the key then to making the revenue go up was to do what?
Teach them how to run their businesses better using our computer system than the way they ran them before they had our computer system.
So in essence, you weren't just selling them something, you were selling them and then having to educate them how to take advantage of what you just sold them.
Well, that's right. So for instance, if you were a vice president of finance of a manufacturing company, I would be showing you how at the end of each week now, Charlie, you can run a little report on your desk and figure out which product lines or which production lines were better than you anticipated and which ones were worse. Or you might be able to rank your product sales by contribution to profit or whatever. So, in other words, I would be trying to show you that you can be a much better CFO if you have my computer system and are using it.
Well, that's a very different angle on sales. Do you remember your first sale that you actually made?
I absolutely do. It was a little engineering firm, and our minimum back then was $1,000 a month. And that was a lot of money for this small business. And my boss, who kind of showed me how to smoke stack and stuff, and we were out there trying to get his business, the sale, and my boss told me ahead of time, he said, "Mike, once we ask for the order, shut up. Don't say a thing, just shut up." Because there was an old J. Douglas Edwards talk on closing, and he always said the first one who talks loses after you ask for the order. And so my boss pounded that into me driving out there. So I asked this guy to get started. His name was John Triber. He was an engineer. He sat there, and for 10 minutes, nobody talked.
That was the longest
10 minutes of my life.
Right, a long pregnant pause there.
But after 10 minutes, he was an engineer. He was an analytic. He was just going through it. He picked his pen up and he signed it.
Very good. So before we get into the solution selling process, can you just give us some ideas? What are the most common selling mistakes that people make?
There's two big ones, and it kind of depends on the nature of what you sell. If you're selling a product, the biggest mistake that salespeople make is they lead with the product before they do any diagnostic to figure out where there might be a fit between the product and the buyer. They just lead with the product, all the features, expecting the buyer to be able to sort them out and know which ones are important and which ones aren't. That's the biggest mistake from product salespeople. From solution salespeople, people selling disruptive technology where it's a new, better way that nobody's ever thought about before, or people selling consulting services. Usually consultants are selling their expertise, right? So people who sell solutions, the biggest mistake they make is as soon as they hear a problem they can relate to on the buyer side, they jump on immediately with, "I can solve that for you," or "Here's the solution," or "Here, we have exactly what you need, and here it is." So they jump and project their solution onto the buyer without taking the time to help the buyer understand the solution and own it first.
So those are two common mistakes or problems people have when they're trying to sell. Is that the natural segue into explaining what prompted you to come up with the solution selling process?
It's as good as any. Coming up with the solution selling process, it was karma. The planets were lined up. I told you about the division of Xerox I was with. Well, the primary Xerox back then was the copier giant, which everybody's familiar with. And in the late 70s, the copier giant had a serious sales problem. They had high pressure to grow, public company, and the growth strategy that they decided to go with was adding salespeople. So they thought, well, gee, last year if we sold $4 billion with 2,000 salespeople, heck, next year we'll hire 2,000 more and we'll sell $8 billion. You've heard that one before, right?
Right.
Not so easy. So the first question is, who's going to manage all those salespeople? Well, what typically happens is they promote the star salespeople to be managers. Now you've done two bad things. You took a guy out of the territory producing 200%, and he's going to ruin four other salespeople because there's nothing more disastrous than a star salesperson promoted to sales manager. Now, the primary reason for that, and we can come back to this later. If you loop back to this next point, it can be made better later.
Okay.
But you've heard of the 80-20 rule.
Right.
It's really 87-13, according to Sales Benchmark Index, which means 16% of the salespeople are bringing in 87% of the business. And that's in corporate America today. So back then, what Xerox, they didn't know if it was 80-20 or 87-13, but they did know that a small percentage of their salespeople were bringing in most of the business, and they were promoting them out of the field to be managers. And the big problem with that is most, the top 13%, those really great salespeople, the intuitive naturals, they do it intuitively. They can't explain to anybody else what they do. And so they crash and burn. So Xerox hired a guy named Neil Rackham, who you've probably heard of. He's the author of Spin Selling.
Yes.
And Neil is a behavioral researcher. And Xerox paid Neil Rackham a lot of money in the late 70s to come in as a behavioral researcher and go out and watch the top 13%. Go out and observe them, since they sell intuitively, observe them as a behavioral researcher and see if you can put together a model of what they do intuitively that we can teach to the bottom 87%. Those were his marching orders when Xerox hired him. And he came up with the SPIN program, and they needed a pilot. And my division of Xerox at the time was doing about $100 million with 100 salespeople and 20 sales managers. And they said, gee, this is a perfect size place to try out this new model. And since once I made that first sale I told you about earlier, in my first 5 months in sales at Xerox Computer Services, I sold more than anybody in the history of the company sold in a full year.
Well, that's fantastic.
Well, so because of that, now, a couple of years later, I'd been promoted from salesperson to sales manager to branch manager, and I was doing all of the new salesperson training for Xerox Computer Services, and so I got to be the pilot, the project leader for the SPIN. So what would you think would be the reason why it would work great selling copiers but not pilot at Xerox? And it fell flat on its work selling tests in Xerox Computer, not Computer Services.
Tell us.
Well, if I were selling a copier, typewriter, or typewriter, a fax machine, that was the sales force that Neil Rackham did his research on. So he was out observing the top 13% of the copier salespeople and the typewriter salespeople and the fax machine salespeople. And all three at work selling computer services, they were selling a product. Remember
Tell us.
When I said about leading with product earlier? They were selling, well, if I were a product that the buyer already understood how selling to use, back then they didn't call on any way of doing your job that you've never thought of before. So our buyers had no clue what we were selling. You see the difference?
Absolutely.
So because of that, the SPIN model assumed the buyer already knew how to use the product. In our division, the buyer had no clue, and that's why the SPIN project bombed. But as a result of it bombing, I realized, having been a support person and made my sales stripes helping people visualize how they could use my product, I added the missing link to SPIN, which was doing a diagnosis and then coming up with some visioning questions, some questions that would help buyers envision themselves, buyers, envisioning to themselves responding if they had money to the product. So just events in their daily life, in the example I gave you earlier, if you were a CFO of a manufacturing company, how I might help you now visualize how every Friday you could rank the profitability of your whole product, all your products before you went home, see which ones are contributing to your products. Or you could see which of your lines on the assembly floor were falling behind and had a problem. So those are ideas that they didn't realize they could do because we were selling something new and different, a better way. And so solution selling came out of the need to help a buyer understand a better way to solve his problems or achieve his goals if he had certain capabilities he doesn't have, which just happened to be in my product.
So that sounds great, but Xerox obviously is a large company. Much of our audience is composed of people who are running businesses that aren't bringing in $100 million a month or a year. They're more in the $5 to $20 million range if they're doing well. Does solution selling apply to smaller business, and who are the best people to
That's a really great question because the first email you sent me, you said that you'd read both my books, Solution Selling and Customer Centric Selling?
Yes.
Well, Solution Selling was really a codification of how Mike Bosworth sold disruptive new technology in the 70s. And it was a process that worked if you were selling high-priced information technology to the enterprise, but it was kind of overcomplicated for selling services and selling less complex products. And, you know, 98% of the market out there is selling things less complex than information technology. And so that really drove the need for customer-centric selling. And what we did is we took what we had learned over 19 years of doing solution selling, and we made it a lot easier to understand, teach, and implement. So you're exactly right. The complexity of that information technology sale over a 9-month sales cycle is way overkill for most companies. And so customer-centric selling, we took the basic principles of you still want to diagnose before you prescribe, you want to help your buyer envision using your product. Those are the same principles, but we made it more understandable and usable by even small businesses, very small businesses, and a lot of independent consultants.
So before we get into the details of how customer-centric selling works, do you have any idea of what kind of difference it can make to the average small business owner in terms of increasing their sales and profits?
Yes. The foundation principle of solution selling and customer-centric selling is to teach the 87% to behave like the 13% in their business, in their market, for their product. And the fact that corporate America, even today, is living with 87-13 tells you that those corporations, as sophisticated as they are and as good as they think they are at Six Sigma and all this stuff, that they haven't really been able to codify on their own what their great salespeople do and institutionalize it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
The number is kind of evidence that they have not figured out a way to institutionalize best practices. So the idea here is if you can get 80% of the salespeople making quota rather than 46%, which is the industry average, all you have to do is sit down and do the math of that. Any business person can do the math of that pretty easily.
But there was a big if in that statement that I heard. So let's say for my business I may have only 5 salespeople. None of them may be that 13%, I don't know, and interested in applying the customer-centric selling to those 5. On average, when you've done that, taken a small company and taught them the customer-centric selling, what kind of gains have they seen given that?
I'd like to give you 2 answers. One would be for an early-stage company, and one would be for a ongoing late-stage business, because they're pretty different.
Very good.
Which one do you want to do first?
Let's start with early-stage.
Early-stage companies typically are founded by an engineer or a scientist or a physicist or a software guy, somebody who's invented a better mousetrap, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what that technical founder does typically is when they think they've got something, they go out and hire a PR firm, and they hire some people to write some white papers, and they hit all the trade shows.
You know, not everybody's going to completely get it right away. Some people may.
And what happens is they...
Some may not.
I'd like to give you 2 answers. One, we end up presenting their new technology, leaders and the early adopters in the market are looking at that new technology and saying, wow, I've been waiting for something like this to come along. So in other words, by looking at it and how they would use it, 80% doesn't. So what they do initially is they just go feast on the early adapters and innovators. But then what, if you've read any Geoffrey Moore, you know, The Chasm, Crossing the Chasm?
Yes.
Most companies, they feast on the innovators and early adopters, and all of a sudden they run out of them and they hit the chasm because they realize that 80% of the market out there doesn't understand why they need their product or how they'd use it. And now they have to go through 9 to 18 months of messaging. They have to now learn how to message their stuff to the mainstream market. And a lot of companies, some companies fall in that chasm and never give out. Okay. So for the early stage companies, we encourage them to get the messaging done before they hit the chasm, and we help them do that. We help them architect the conversations between the mainstream market buyer of their product, who really we're going to assume initially at the first meeting doesn't understand why he would need it or how he would use it.
So if you can pick an example of a small company that you've worked with, and they've maybe been through that initial 20% and they're struggling, and then you have helped them with the messaging, what's the bump in sales that they've seen?
The bump in sales is significant because, I mean, if you really think about it, they probably get all 5 of their salespeople making quota instead of, on average, even if you only had 5 salespeople, probably only 2 of them are making quota.
So percentage-wise, what might that mean in terms of an increase in sales?
Well, I would say it's pretty easy to say that if five people make quota instead of two, you could certainly double your sales pretty easily, envision doubling your sales pretty easily.
Well, that sounds like a number worth striving for. So how does it work in later stage businesses?
Later stage businesses are typically more of selling a product or service that the buyer already thinks he or she understands. They might not understand the latest and greatest wrinkles, but they kind of have an idea how it works, and the salespeople fall into the trap of looking for a need and then jumping on it by projecting a solution onto them. And so the main value we give for later stage businesses and expert to non-expert businesses is we slow them down and we teach them how to get in sync with the buy cycle of the buyer, because people love to buy, but they hate to feel sold.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can help the buyer buy, I've been saying for years to salespeople that I'd love to run into them in Chicago O'Hare Airport a year after I train them, and they hand me their business card, and it says buying facilitator instead
okay.
of marketing rep or sales engineer or salesperson, whatever, because people love to buy. So for later stage companies, we teach them how to win by providing a superior customer experience, because we're assuming with most of the later stage companies, they have a lot more competition. They're not an innovative new way to do it. They're out there slugging it out in deal after deal with three or four or five competent competitors. Does that make sense?
That does.
So what we're trying to teach them is to win on process. If you can provide a superior buying experience, then you can win even though your product is just average.
So we've got roughly 25, 30 minutes here today. Imagine I was an owner of a small business. You can pick the generic type of business that you get most frequently. And imagine you had to teach me and teach the listeners who are of small business owners the key elements of customer-centric selling so that we could put your system to use and start using it tomorrow.
All right. I'll give you an example of a business that we worked with a few years ago. It was a local overnight delivery service.
Okay.
They're competing with FedEx and UPS.
And what was their situation when you started with them?
They were regional. They were just California, Arizona, Nevada, and they were struggling. And when their salespeople went in, the primary thing they would say within the first 30 seconds is, we're cheaper than FedEx and UPS, so you should use us. They were going in trying to win just strictly on a lower price.
Which is a losing game.
A losing game. We taught them to first figure out, what do they do better than the big guys? Well, a couple of the things they do better. One is they can pick up something as late as 8 o'clock at night and still get it there the next day, because they do trucks just between these three states. So that's one advantage. Another advantage is they can deliver first thing in the morning. Another advantage is they can deliver on pallets. So we help them, instead of just going out into all businesses selling, you know, we're local, we're less risk because your stuff isn't on an airplane and we're cheaper, we would help them position themselves differently. But what they had to learn was you don't have the same sales conversation on every sales call if you're selling overnight delivery. So we taught them that if you're calling on a law firm, you'd ask questions like, have you ever been frustrated because the last FedEx pickup was 5 o'clock and your attorneys were working till 7:30, 8 o'clock at night on something that they wanted the client to have the next day? Now, how many law firms would say yes to that? They worked those guys like slaves, right?
Absolutely.
So that was a huge advantage to be able to do a pickup as late as 8 o'clock at night. So, and then for construction companies that don't have maybe even street addresses yet, they're just, you know, in a block, or they need things delivered on pallet, who are buying big heavy things like bathtubs and plumbing and fixtures, their delivery service could get them delivered much faster than the big guys on pallets locally. So in other words, we taught them how to have conversations based on the customer's business rather than their product. Does that make sense?
That does. And just so I've got it down here, the first element was to help them, rather than trying to compete head-to-head with the big guys,
right,
was to identify the unique characteristics of their services and or their products that differentiated them from the big guys and hopefully gave them a competitive advantage.
Yes, but then we had to teach them how to actually bring the subject up in a non-salesy consultative fashion.
And
that was the big
key element that you mentioned when you were describing that was...
And so when they would call on companies like that...
Structuring the sales conversation around questions.
Questions, exactly. Questions are much better than statements, especially coming from the lips of a salesperson. Because Neil Rackham discovered long ago that the best sales calls are conversations, not presentations.
Absolutely.
The only way you can have a conversation with your buyer is to ask them questions. So we would teach the salespeople to first ask questions. For instance, if you went into a law firm and asked the managing partner and said, do your attorneys ever work past 5 o'clock at night and would still like to get something delivered to the client the next day? And they say, nope. We have a policy here. We focus on quality of life of our attorneys, and we make them all leave by 5 o'clock every day. Okay, now if that was the answer, then you would never bring up that advantage of your product because it doesn't fit.
Absolutely. So that would be a unique law firm.
So we would tailor all the questions about product usage back to first finding out by doing a couple diagnostic questions, would they have a need for this advantage of our product? And the diagnostic questions help discover that. And so if you're asking 4 diagnostic questions and they only respond to 2 of them, then you're only going to be able to present 2 product capabilities.
So for the average...
Big, heavy things like bathtubs and plumbing and fixtures.
Small business owner, the first thing they would need to do to...
Delivery service could
put the system
delivered much faster
system in place would be A, to identify their unique characteristics of their service or products, but also then be come up with a tentative script, say, of the diagnostic questions they should be leading with when they
exactly.
have a conversation with a prospect.
And if they picked up a copy of my book, Customer Centric Selling, I hate to do the shameless plug, but it fits so well. There's a template for building those questioning conversational tools in the book. But the first step really is for the senior executive of any of our clients and our people. We sit down. Sometimes it takes about 4 hours, and we come up with a targeted conversation list. What are the conversations that we know in advance that 90% of the time your frontline salespeople are going to have
to walk prospects through to get to the point where you have that pregnant pause and you're waiting for them to ask for the order?
Exactly, and the sequence is based on how people like to buy. At the core of our model is a buy cycle.
If you could just map that out for our listeners, that'd be very helpful.
Well, there's 4 primary things somebody thinks about when they make a buying decision. 1, do I have a need to change? 2, do I see a product or service that appears to meet my need? What's the cost of doing it, and what's the risk of doing it?
So once the small business owner understands that buying cycle, then what are the things that they need to do to match it with their behavior?
The simplest thing I could give your listeners, Charlie, would be to think about their buyer as going to
have that pregnant
3 phases in their buy cycle. The first phase is the need phase. Does this buyer have a need for what we sell? The second phase would be the proof stage. Now that we know they have a need for what we sell, we want to give them whatever proof they need so they're convinced that our product will meet their vision, that our company's services will meet their vision, that
waiting for
our company takes care of their
customers,
whatever, you know,
the order.
Proof they need. Does that make sense? And then the third phase, that's when they're exactly have effectively in order to get your going to products sold in advance. Start thinking about the risk and the price and to be able to bring home the business without dropping price.
Well, it sounds in theory, very simple. So what's the reality of the challenge of implementing it?
The reality of the challenge of implementing it is that by nature, whether they're in the 13% or the 87%, by nature, salespeople like to wing it. Salespeople are just-in-time, opportunity-specific learners. The nature of the beast. It's the nature of the human being that goes into sales.
Given that, how do you get the people to adopt customer-centric selling?
Well, we have to help a client design a sales process that does a couple of things. That one facilitates the buyer experience. So we know that if the salesperson follows this process, our buyer is going to have a superior experience. And two, a process that enables the 87% to behave on purpose the way the top 13% behave intuitively.
But that's the challenge. That's what I'm asking, though, is it difficult? So if I'm a
well, it isn't
person,
because we've done it so hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, so we pretty much have templates of how people buy, and we have templates for selling large, complex systems to the government. We have templates for sales. We've done this so much and applied it to so many businesses that pretty much any business that comes along now, one of our tribe has got direct experience in their business and can help us really tweak our model and our templates to fit their businesses.
That makes sense.
Processes for selling overnight delivery services.
That's great.
In other words, we've done this so much and applied it to so many businesses.
I was asking was one of the things you suggested earlier, which I think is probably true, is a lot of people who go into sales tend to be the more wing-it type.
Right.
Personality.
You want to get back to that?
So how do you get them to adopt a more structured approach that uses these templates?
Well, some of it's behavioral change. One of the things we do is after we create the conversational templates, we call them solution development prompters, we then put them through 3 to 4 days of training where they role play all those conversations that they're going to have out there. So they role play in advance the conversation with the CFO, and they role play in advance the conversation with the managing partner of the law firm.
So you get people to practice using the new...
Practice. Now, the nice thing about those solution development prompters is they're all, we write one for each targeted conversation. So if you have 10 targeted conversations, we have 10 solution development prompters. If you have 100 targeted conversations, then we have to write 100 solution development prompters. So we write in advance, we pre-architect in advance all the conversations on the conversation list, on the targeted conversation list, and then we role play the salespeople before they ever go out and have those conversations. Now, still, even though we do that, if I'm the sales manager, I'm still not out there with that salesperson on the call, right?
Right.
The biggest problem that managers have with salespeople and sales process is how do you assess the outcome of a call you weren't there for? And what most sales managers do is say, well, they ask the salesperson, how'd the call go? And what do most salespeople say?
It went great.
Oh, it went great. They love us. Right? Okay. So, in other words, we have to come up with a process, and the first step of the process has to solve that problem. And so, as we structure debriefing questions for the manager, and because a lot of managers are busy, execute this model, they get a short of our client, not of management attention. What they do is for the first 30 days until a salesperson proves that they can act, we have the sales answers to the debriefing people, call the manager's voicemail after every sales call and questions. That way, if the manager's, it's 8 o'clock at night and the manager's on the road at the Holiday Inn in St. Louis, Missouri, he or she can call their voicemail and listen to the answers and only react to the exceptions. And so the better the answers, the less attention the salespeople get.
If you can, I'd like you to sort of scale it down to imagine that
they get a lot of management attention. And so we have the salespeople.
Plant, I'm doing
doing
10 to $15 million of business.
Okay.
And my niche is in-store signage for chains like JCPenney or something. But it basically, my sales force consists of me and, you know, maybe one or two other people in my company. So there's a small group, and I'm going to have to do everything from developing the unique characteristics to the questions to managing my own behavior in terms of implementing them.
How would
you suggest that work?
Well, that's an excellent question. But if you think about it, in that kind of a scenario, what's the worst thing that can happen to you or your salesperson? And that is that you would work multiple months on a large potential deal and lose. It would be much better for that salesperson to make one call, and you, the manager, you say, you know what, based on what I'm hearing, this isn't worth our time. I'm going to pull the plug on this one. Come of the call. So we would want to want the salesperson to be able to answer certain questions before we management decide to invest into a long-term expensive campaign. Questions like, are you talking to somebody who can buy? Does that person have a goal or a problem that matches up with what we do real well? Sure, and we'd want the salesperson to be able to answer certain questions before we management diagnose the problem. Do you see enough potential value in the goal that they'd want to achieve monetarily, money-wise, or do you see enough cost savings in how they'd use our product to save money that you think this is worth their time and their money and therefore a campaign for us? In other words, and then what's their vision of a solution? Do they understand that we can pick up as late as 8 o'clock at night and still get it there by 8 o'clock the next morning? Do they get that? And so what we have debriefing questions, but what we really would want is the seller to communicate all of that in writing back to the prospect after the call. Once that's in writing and we have a structure for how that email, it's usually done via email now these days rather than even snail mail. But once that verbiage is put in writing, that becomes the need qualification vehicle. And you've heard for years salespeople talk about qualification. Qualification is best done in two bites rather than one. And the bite budget we like is need qualification. Before we get it even into do the money, et cetera, before we get into an event coming up where our printing services would give them an advantage because we can do it 4 weeks faster, any of that, which is in the big guy box, and they've got a qualification. The need qualification, narrow window and up, in other words, do they have a need that matches up with what we do?
Absolutely.
Too many companies don't do that. You know, they're asking the salesperson, do they have budget? Yeah, they got budget. How much is their budget? $80,000. You know, they're into the can they buy and will they buy without taking the time to really assess the need and make sure that the vision of the solution has been created in phase one, the needs phase, as we diagnose and create the vision in the first phase of the buy cycle. The second phase is proof. Then we send out the experts and do the demonstrations, et cetera. So we have to be in sequence with the way people buy.
Absolutely. And then after the demonstration, the next phase in the buy cycle again is?
Well, it's needs, details, consequences. Now it's helping the buyer through their fear of risk, because what happens is that all of a sudden now there's a risk of not doing buyers winning it and a risk of doing it. If you think about the last time you bought a house, most people look at 5, 6, 7 properties, and they get closer and closer to before they're buying, their fear of narrow risk starts going up. And all of a sudden, but now there's a risk, right?
Absolutely.
Of the 6 or 7 properties you looked at the last time you bought a house, how many of them did you have inspected for termites?
Only one.
So in other words, the buyer is going to go negative on the one that they want to buy from the most. And that throws a lot of salespeople off in phase three. And so what happens is they overreact and panic when the buyer appears to go negative.
And what's the answer to that? What should one do?
What should one do is empathize. I know it is a big decision. Not overreact. When salespeople get reactive, they really start losing because the buyer can sense their stress.
Okay.
So The first thing is the salesperson should smile if the buyer is going negative, because that means they're column A, because there's only one salesperson seeing that negative behavior. Column B, C, and D aren't seeing that behavior.
So it's a good sign when clients, when your prospect starts to grill you.
Question you, now can you guys really do this? You know, I want to talk to three more people that have gone through this project. I want to make sure that you guys really have your act together. Those are all positive buying signs, because that means they envision using your product. But a lot of salespeople freak out, because when the buyer is in phase one and phase two, the buyer is very excited. They're visualizing, they're thinking about a way to do it better, and then they see your product and they go, oh my God, that's perfect. We love your product. So salespeople get seduced by that. But then they think about, oh geez, this is really a lot of money. God, what if the economy goes sour? What if our buyers all of a sudden stop buying automobiles? They start going into the negative consequences. And a lot of salespeople blow the sale by overreacting.
And instead of overreacting, they should
empathize and then refresh the buyer's memory. Say, Charlie, it is a big decision, but let's not forget why we spent the last 3 months together. You're losing two out of every four campaigns you're working on. The reasons you're losing are, you told me the only way you're going to get your productivity up is to have capabilities A, B, and C. And when we took you out to the ABC company and the XYZ company, and you talked to both of their CFOs, you know, they told you that they got those same capabilities that you're looking for. So yes, it's a big decision, but it's the right thing to do for you and your business, and we're ready to go when you are.
What comes next after that?
You shut up.
Very good. And you wait for the buyer to ask for the order.
Yeah, because you've done your job. We're ready when you are. You can shut up and wait.
And that's the hardest thing, I think,
said,
for people who are experienced salespeople and tend to be extroverts and talkers to do. But it's the most powerful thing, because when the buyer asks for the order, you have much more assurance that you sold them than if you try to ask them.
Right. And or if you quote-unquote close them.
Any additional mistakes that people make along the way that they should make sure to avoid quote-unquote, trying to close their buyers?
Well, a lot of it is back at the office. A lot of salespeople get happy ears.
They get what?
Happy ears.
Okay.
That means they hear all the things they want to hear, but they avoid the potential negatives. And one of the best salespeople I ever knew, he said, we have to sell paranoid and cover the bases and put everything in writing, but nice writing, low pressure, facilitate the buying process, lots of written communication. If you look at the top 13% of those salespeople, they're not only great verbal communicators, but they're great written communicators. They document, document, document.
So that's a great tip. So speaking of tips, we've been talking a lot about, you know, managing the sales process. One of the things we haven't talked about much is lead generation. And there's one area of lead generation that people are always looking for good ideas on, and that's around cold calling. And I was wondering if you had any tips around cold calling.
Well, I do. You know, if you think about it, what we do is we have people draw a circle. Well, we draw a circle on the flip chart, and we say, all right, think of this circle as your sales territory. And then we'll go around and ask salespeople, describe your territory for me. And eventually we get around to, well, my territory is anybody that's got a manufacturing business of more than 10 employees in these zip codes. And we say, well, how many are in there? And they'd say 720. And I say, all right, right now today, how many of those 720 are actively looking for what you sell? And that's typically a very low percentage. People already actively looking for what you sell, right?
Right.
So then you take the rest of them. So 5% are looking and 95% are not looking. Then yes, we ask them, well, how many of those 95% should be looking based on what you know? And a lot of companies will say, gee, a big percentage of them should be looking. Okay. So let's just say that I'm selling customer-centric selling training. I know that in the people not looking for sales training, that the vast majority of those companies are really doing a terrible job of sales forecasting. And so if I think about that, their vice president of sales in a lot of these companies is under a lot of heat for an inaccurate sales force. But so rather than call on the VP of sales, who's the person who's most frustrated each month with that lousy forecast, Charlie?
It's either the CFO or the CEO.
Exactly. So as an example for a cold call, what if I called a CFO of a target company and I said, Charlie, this is Mike Bosworth with Customer Centric Selling, and you and I haven't spoken before, but we've been working with other, whatever the type of business you are, you know, for the last 4 years. One of the chief problems I'm hearing from other CFOs is their frustration over missed revenue targets because big deals slip at the last minute. We've been able to help our clients overcome that problem, and I'd like an opportunity to share with you how. Now, that took about 20 seconds. Our hit rate on that is about 80%.
And the key you're suggesting is instead of just randomly calling and hoping you're going to find an interested prospect, first identify for the industry that you're targeting the people in the positions in that industry of the people who are feeling the most pain.
And we already have them. Remember the targeted conversation list, which is the very first thing we do with each client?
Yes.
Targeted conversation list. So now for each of those targeted conversations, we can come up with a phone script. We can write a phone script that doesn't start pitching the product, doesn't start using words that really bother prospects, like we're the leading provider of this and the biggest thing of that, you know, things that sound like opinions. We've gotten pretty good at writing phone scripts over the years.
So
and the real net of it is, in 20 seconds, because your window of opportunity on a cold call is 20 seconds, you might be interested in. That's
so
it.
You're using curiosity, you're using social proof.
Right.
And identifying, hitting on the pain.
Are you curious
of that
how one of your peers has already achieved a goal
that should
potential pain? Now, but
potential pain.
Because
right.
Will you admit pain to a stranger in 20 seconds on the phone? I won't.
No, absolutely not.
No, so
right.
We can't accuse them of having the pain. We can't say, are you having a problem doing your forecast? That's too big a question to answer.
We've just got a few minutes to wrap up here.
Okay.
But my question for you is for many people, small business owners, and I'd say probably a lot of people out there right now, that the current economy has certainly been a tough one, and from their perspective, a very tough one for selling practically anything.
Right.
And they don't have a lot of time. They're approaching the year end, and they're not meeting their goals, and they're looking for results, you know, instantly.
That you might be interested.
What would you recommend they do tomorrow, next week, next month to hopefully restore their sales?
Well, the first thing I would do is I would look at every single pipeline of every single salesperson, and I would try to rank those prospects not by the size of the sale or not by the probability of closing that the salesperson thinks, but rank them by the value of our product to their business.
All right.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because right now, when you think about phase three and this uncertain economy, there's a whole bunch of companies not buying things right now. They are just holding off, waiting, right?
Yes.
So to me, I just, first by nature, or by definition, business is going to be slow. So if I'm going to spend my time anywhere, I want to spend my time on the opportunities that have the best business case, okay? Where I'm convinced that my prospective prospect could save $10,000 a month if he had my product, which only costs $42,000, for instance, you know, where I really understand the business value. And then the second thing is if you can be flexible on payment terms. If you can't, you can't. But if you're solid enough that you can help these companies that need your product the most so their business will make more money or save money, and you can be in these hard times.
Those are two good ideas. Now, we've talked or briefly mentioned two of your books, Solution Selling and Customer Centric Selling. Are there other books that people should take a look at, and do you offer any additional programs or services?
Well, our primary business is going out client by client and doing custom training where we first go out and help them re-architect their messaging to the mainstream market so that people who don't know they need their product or how they would use it, and we re-architect their messaging by targeted conversations. And then so every workshop we do is custom, where we're helping them, we're integrating their product training and their sales training, because if you think about it, real selling is helping buyers visualize how they're going to use your product. So your product or service has to be part of your definition of what selling is, and it has to be part of the conversation. So they have to be integrated.
And if people are interested in learning more about that, what's the easiest way for them to get a hold
of
you?
Well, to go to customercentric.com. And we do have 4 to 6 times a year we have public workshops where you can go on a onesie basis if you want and check it out. Audit the program, learn the messaging model, and learn the structure for the phone scripts and the cold calls and all that stuff. You can go on a onesie basis.
So if you're a relatively small business and you can't necessarily afford to bring you in to do the architecting, you could send your salespeople or go to that
exactly.
Yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Because we typically won't do a custom program for fewer than 15 people.
And when are the next two of those public programs?
You know, Charlie, I'm embarrassed to tell you that I'd have to go onto my own website and look.
So if they want to find out information about that, they
should customercentric.com.
Great. Well, thank you. This has been a great interview.
Thank you, Charlie. It's been my pleasure.